Hello and welcome to episode 22 of the Derailed Podcast. I'm Chris.
And I'm Fred.
And Fred, I think you have a very important message for the Train Shuffling Podcast, do you not?
Yes, I do. So that was awesome. I was listening to episode 2 of the Train Shuffling Podcast and they were trying to figure out that term we came up with, which is Lola, guys, left of last action.
It was so close. And Fred's like been trying so hard to make this a thing. He's like, I'm going to make this a thing. This is going to be my legacy. This is what people will remember me for, is Lola. Right? And then they were talking about it and they were like, oh, you know, the zero guys had a good term for it. What is it? Lotlo? And you sent me, before I'd even listened to the episode, you sent me a clip of it.
Yeah.
And I was listening. I was like, come on, guys. It's so close.
They were so close. So close. Maybe it's not catchy enough. I don't know. I mean, why have to work?
No. I think it's good. I don't think we need to workshop it any further. Otherwise, no one will ever remember.
Okay.
Yeah. But at least you're there. It's becoming a thing.
Yeah.
You're going to make it happen, Fred.
I got quite a kick out of listening to them trying to remember it.
Yeah. But I'm sure you were sitting there the whole time like, please. Yeah. Get it. Validate me. This is what I have.
Yeah, that was quite funny.
Oh, man. Yeah. Do we have any other exciting news? The Kickstarter funded, the 1861-1867.
Yes, that's right.
Kickstarter. So I saw that there were 2,000 and something backers.
Wow, that's
And I thought, that's pretty insane, actually. Mm. If you consider that some of those people are going to be like 4-packs or whatever.
Yes, yeah.
That's a lot of copies of an 18XX game.
Yeah, that is. That's good, yeah.
I don't know what Chesapeake got. I think it got maybe even bigger numbers.
Did you see that Facebook post that someone posted, I think today, about like a little bit of the history of 18XX and people trying to publish it and stuff?
Oh, no, I didn't.
It was very good. So Jason, B-E-G-Y, Jason. Anyway, Jason posted about the availability and the current state of 18XX. And it's a good post. It's in the Train Games Board Train Board Game Group on Facebook. Yeah. So I won't read the whole thing. It's quite long, but very interesting. Basically, he posted about some companies who tried to publish and they would print like 2,200 copies of an 18XX and only managed to sell 1,000 and then go bankrupt because the other 1,200 they had to write off and stuff. It's very interesting and how that's all changing now. But I think Kickstarter is a good way to do that. We've spoken about that before.
Yeah, definitely. Was it 56 that was one of those where they got like a big mass production, but they produced a lot of it? I think this was after the success of 1830. Mm. And then it just sort of, I think it just sat for ages in like warehouses and stuff. I think it just took them forever to move the stock.
He mentions here in the mid-90s, Mayfair printed 5,000 copies of 56 and 1870.
Okay, so it was bankrupted 56. Them.
Jeez. And he says, to this day, you can still find sealed copies of those original 5,000.
Yeah.
Which was printed in the 90s, which is crazy.
That's insane. We have a game of 56 going on right now, actually, online game.
You do? I'm not in that.
Yeah, some pairs really into that one.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. So we had one of those going. It's a very weird system though. It's a very weird game. So the capitalization is super strange. So you can take loans that you have to like pay, $100 loans that you have to pay $10 on every OR. Okay. Something like that. But then the capitalization is really weird. So it starts out sort of like an incremental cap game, but only up to the fifth share, but you can buy more than the fifth share. But then you only get capitalized for your 6th to 10th share once you connect 2 points on the map with that company. So every company has a destination.
Every single one. Kind of like that one company in, which one is it? Where the bank
pre-purchases
the first 3 shares. Yeah,
that's in Rhineland. Yeah. So yeah, and then only after that will the other shares start paying in when you buy them. But the shares don't increase in value. The market price increases, but the IPO value remains the same. So even when you buy them, so it's not like 46 where you can buy them later and put more money in. Mm. I don't know. It's super weird. I think the capitalization changes again, maybe to full cap or something after the 5 train is bought.
Oh, interesting.
Okay. I haven't got there yet. It's all very confusing. So I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing. I've only got one company and it reached its destination. And I'm like seriously plodding.
Yeah.
I'm just like buying another share of this company. Yay. Yeah, and I've got like 1-3 train and like not enough money to buy another train. I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know if I'm supposed to be floating another one, but it's not like full cap yet where you can just float another company and like finance the other one or whatever. So I don't know. I have no idea what I'm doing.
Yeah, it just shows you there are so many levers we haven't even seen yet in 18xx's. Eh? Yeah.
So that's quite an interesting one. I think quite an old one, I think, especially based on what you're saying here. That is one of the ones that they printed a bunch of copies of.
Yeah.
So I've heard that story before, that it was just kind of a disaster. I think there was kind of a lot of interest after 1829 and 1830. Those are the kind of two original ones, as far as I know. And then, I don't know. I guess it turned out to be more of a niche than they thought. And now we're seeing all this renewed interest.
Yeah, but Kickstarter is a better way to do that, because companies don't run the risk of printing all these copies that they then won't be able to sell. With Kickstarter, you know you've sold them before you print them. So.
And I wonder how much GMT's 1846 has to do with the kind of resurgence, I guess.
I wonder. That's how we started. Mm. So, I mean, that's small sample size, but yeah. It I think it does help to have something available on a walk into a, physical game store and see a copy on the shelf and, I've heard of these games. Let's give it a try kind of thing.
Yeah, and 46 is a little bit more hand-holdy. It's a little bit more Euro-ish.
Mm.
It feels like it gives you a little bit more structure to work with. Mm. Maybe than if you jumped just straight into 1830, expecting like some kind of a Euro game.
Yes.
And you just be like, what are we doing?
Yeah,
so it's quite interesting. But that is cool. I'm glad to see these Kickstarters doing so well.
Mm.
All of them have been well beyond funded, so there's plenty of interest.
Yeah.
And I think there's a whole 18xx community that generally just rallies behind them as well, because we all want to see it grow. We all want to see it be successful. So when it comes to 18xx, I don't even like if I'm buying a board game, I like research it and reviews or whatever. I'm like, 18xx came on Kickstarter, cool, back.
Yeah.
I have no idea how much we'll like the 61, 67 or whatever. I'm like,
Yeah, but you're becoming a collector as well.
So. Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. It does feel like that with 18xx specifically. We just kind of want to acquire more of them. And that's kind of the thing. There's a whole scarcity thing with them, right? Mm. Is that there's times when you can buy them and they're not that expensive. But then, I mean, within a year or 2 years from there, they can be astronomically expensive.
Yeah.
Probably won't be the case as much with these mass-produced ones. But I saw even 46 has gone up a lot.
Yeah, apparently it's not so easy to get hold of anymore.
Yeah, now people are selling that
on
the markets and whatever for
well-inflated
prices. They must have just
printed a fixed bunch of them as well, and they're slowly being sold. So
I think what they were planning on doing with that is actually doing another P500 for it.
Oh, okay.
Like a P500 reprint for that. Okay. One. Yeah. So we will see.
Yeah.
But I think there's quite a lot on the horizon.
Mm. That's nice. That's good.
Yeah. So we haven't gotten to our email stuff yet, but I think it's relevant to this topic. Per sent us an email. He was saying there was kind of a debate around Kickstarter at the moment and whether it's good or bad.
Mm.
For 18xx. I think a lot of people were upset specifically with All Aboard Games directions. So they had a catalog of, don't quote me on it, I'm going to randomly guess, somewhere around maybe like 12 games, maybe more, that you could order from them. They had a pretty quick turnaround time. That's where I got 89 from.
Right, okay.
And that guy, Scott Peterson, would just sort of hand make all these games.
As the orders came in.
Yes, as the orders came in. And he'd have a few like backed up or whatever, so maybe when he made them, I think he'd make like 10 copies
of maybe got 5 orders, so he'd make 10 and then
something like that, right? But he had a pretty quick turnaround on time on those, which was something that was very different from some of the other offers. Deep Thought Games, Scott was making some of Deep Thought Games stuff, but Deep Thought Games actual website, people talk about years of waiting and it just never really materializing. And then Golden Spike Games was one that took on some of the slack, but then they were also waiting lists of like a year or 2 years. I think they've recently got it down quite a lot. They've been trying to catch up, but All Aboard Games became this very reliable way of getting these sort of handmade games. So now he's sort of shut down that handmade store, or semi-shut it down. He's going to be doing a few, but he's focusing now on the mass-produced stuff. So some people are upset about that, right? Because now you can only order 1817, 18 mechs, or 18 Chesapeake, basically. So they're saying there's less availability and all of that.
Yeah.
I don't know what you think about that.
I don't know. It's difficult. I mean, you can't be upset with someone creating a business or someone taking away a business that they had created. Like,
well, this is kind of the thing, right? Is because it's such a small, relatively small community.
Yeah.
And you have this company that sort of is like the only place to get some of these games, and then it disappears.
Mm.
The reliable way of getting them. And the problem with this is like, if these people disappear, like there's actually just no way to get them. the files aren't like readily available for you to print yourself. That's true for a few games, but for many it's not, because they're licensed to that person or whatever. So I think that's where people get upset, because they want whatever game. And this is a notorious problem in 18xx, right? Someone will post a picture like, oh, I'm playing a game of 18 whatever, and it's great and blah, blah, blah. And you're like, oh, that looks cool. Where can I get it?
Can't get it.
You can get it on eBay for $400 or whatever. You know, it came out 5 years ago and they printed 100 copies. And that seems to be the case with a lot of 18xx stuff. I mean, the amount of actual titles relative to the number of titles that are actually available, that gap is pretty big. That being said, I actually think there are quite a lot of titles that are still readily available. If you just want to buy some decent 18xx games, you're pretty spoiled for choice.
Right.
In that sense. The problem is if you want something specific that you see people playing or whatever, you might not be able to get it.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of winsome ones that were shipped out years ago as part of that. Like, I don't know if you know how Winsome operates. It's like a subscription service. You paid like $100 and he'd send you like a pack of games.
Okay. I think you've mentioned that before.
Yeah. So those are pretty rare. And often there were oftentimes 18xx's in there. Usually you'd need 1830 to play them.
And for the components and stuff.
Yeah. So we use like the 1830 tile sets and stuff. Right. But stuff like that, I mean, and that component quality is as low as it gets. It's like printed colored paper and stuff, like cutouts, you know, and you'll see that going for like $100 plus. It's actually just like a paper map and like some cutout paper charters and whatever. Not like high quality stuff at all.
No, I mean, obviously you can be upset that something isn't available, but you can't be upset at the people kind of taking it away. But also, like, I've always been a big proponent of open source software and things like that, but I understand that kind of licenses are necessary for some things and so on. But I think if I were to publish an 18xx and I had the sole license for that 18xx, if I then decided to stop publishing it for some reason, I think it's would be just nice to then release that license to the public domain and say, okay, I've done what I wanted to do with this. I've made some money or whatever, or I'm not making money, so it's not feasible for me to carry on. So here you go, have at it, print it for yourself.
Kind of well, thing. This is kind of interesting. The one of the ones, there's a few games that are around that's this debate kind of centers around of like, is it okay to print this or not? So the best example is actually 1849,
okay,
which we have a printed copy of. So there are plenty of 1849 files floating around. There's lots of redraws and all of that.
Right.
The problem is there seems to be this confusion around who actually owns the rights to 1849, and the designer has rather notoriously just like dropped off the face of the earth. No one seems to be able to talk to him. He never like posts anything online or anything like that. So even now, people are busy trying to rewrite the rules for 1849 because there's some things that aren't clear. And they can't contact the designer in order to clarify. And it's the same with the licensing issue.
Yes.
No one really knows. There's like, you'll hear like a person spoke to this person who spoke to this person who said he's not that happy about people printing it or whatever. But is he making any money off of it in general? I know All Aboard Games prints 1849, or they were. I think that's high up on their next to mass produce list though. But yeah, so there's so much confusion around it in general.
That kind of sounds like abandonware to me.
It is almost like that. Yeah, there's like this murky ethics, and some people are kind of like, if have the position of like, well, if I can't buy it,
I'm going
and
to
it's
print
readily
it.
Available to print, then I'm not costing anyone any money. Kind of thing, which I guess is the same argument people would make for abandonware, where it's like, if you don't give me a way to legally purchase this, I'm not
taking money away
money.
From anyone.
But that's the thing. I mean, I guess the problem with that comes in where there's this future potential. Like abandonware is mostly just that, right? Like people aren't going to develop it again. But with 18xx licenses, someone could pick it up for Kickstarter tomorrow. Like, oh, now I'm kickstarting 1849 and now I'm publishing it or whatever. So if you've printed it, you have almost cost like future income.
Yeah, because if you've got a printed copy, you might not back the Kickstarter now.
Right.
Kind of thing. Yeah, it is tricky. It is very tricky.
So yeah, so when we printed 1849, I was totally oblivious to all this stuff. There was just someone posted a redraw on Facebook. I was like, oh, that's really sweet.
Yeah,
so I don't know, but I think it's generally there's a few that are kind of murky. There's some that just don't exist, and there's some that are totally open. Like 1889, the designers said multiple times, like, go for it.
Yeah.
And that was even on All Aboard Games website, they actually had the files to print 1899 yourself, even though they sold it.
Oh, yeah, that's a good way to do it. That's
yeah, well, the Grand Trunk Games, who just did the Kickstarter of 1861-67, there are PNP files available 61-67.
Oh, awesome,
and
yeah.
That guy, Joshua, just actually wrote a blog post about this dilemma of, like, do I say take these files down or whatever, but he decides to just leave them publicly available.
I think that's a good way to do it. That's very much in line with the world of open source software, where you can freely download the software and use it as you like, but then there are companies that offer support on top of it and things like that, and they make money that way. But the software is still available. So I think that's fine. Make the print and play files available, but if people don't want to go to the effort of printing it themselves, also sell a copy that they can just buy
for convenience. Well, that's the way, I mean, in the kind of new world, so to speak, they've combated piracy, right? Which was convenience.
Yeah.
Like, it's actually easier to have Netflix than it is to, like, torrent movies or whatever.
Yeah.
So piracy these days has essentially been beaten by convenience.
Yeah.
And I think that's where piracy really thrived, was for a while it was more convenient
than
the legit stuff. And that's when piracy really became a problem. When people would buy something legally and then pirate it because the pirated version had less, like, DRM crap to deal with, with music with software, and software and all that kind of stuff, right? Yeah. I used to do that. I used to pirate games that I owned
because
the pirate copy was less of a pain in the ass to deal with, which is ridiculous.
Yeah.
But that was Joshua's argument basically was, I'm offering this game for $60. It's going to be in a nice box with nice components and nice artwork. You can print it yourself, but it's probably going to cost you, like, what, $40 or $50 to, like, print it.
And so is your time worth $20 or not, you know?
Yeah,
that's the question.
And we know board gamers will pay for nice stuff.
Yeah,
I would much rather have a really nice printed copy that's really looks legit and has really nice components and a proper box and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
For $60, it's like a no-brainer.
Yeah.
And I think that's where the mass-produced stuff, because they can cut down on those margins. You know, the handmade games were $100 and up a lot of the time, which makes it then more of a proposition of maybe I want to do it printed myself. Also because the handmade stuff is also following a similar process that you would follow. And it's the same artwork and all that kind of jazz. So, yeah, I don't know. But I think in terms of these Kickstarter stuff where they have nice components and artwork and all this kind of stuff going on, I think they're not really in danger of having their lunch eaten by the guy with the printer and a laminator.
Yeah, but it's an interesting question because you don't really have that for any other board gaming. Like if you look at, I don't know, Terra Mystica or something, there's no question about the print and play files aren't available or anything. But it's all part because it's so niche, I think. Because it's so niche, it's kind of like a community. Some of the players create their own games and they make it available and those become popular and then they get print runs and things.
I think a big part of it is 18XX games are 95% just paper.
Yeah.
I mean, they're just paper components, right? It's just printed paper stuff. Mm. There's not like different units and cubes and shapes and wooden cutouts and all these different tiles that you need and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. If you think of an average Euro that we play, there's like these little tiles that you put over here and like these cubes that you here and these meeples that you put here and all these different, like four different types of resources with like their own. I mean, producing that yourself, even if you had all the files, is actually just a major pain.
Yeah.
And you have to source all these like wooden components and stuff, whereas 18XX is mostly just paper and round wooden tokens.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they're actually a lot easier to print and play than...
Yeah, that's true. But there's also the problem of how does the designer get paid for their time? Like, is it expected to just be like an act of love that they created this game? Or should you be expected to get some money if you design a good 18XX? I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting. I guess you go in with that in mind when you first do it, right? When you design something. Either you just want to put it out there and say, sure, go ahead, print it, play it. I like people playing my game. That's cool. Or you're going out there and you shopping it to publishers and saying, I have this design. Would you be interested in buying it or licensing it or whatever the case may be?
Interesting.
But I think there are plenty of people who design stuff just to put it out there.
Yeah.
I guess everyone has their own things, right? Like JC Lawrence has 1828, but his thing is that he wants you to create it yourself.
Yeah.
So part of that is having more people have the equipment and the tools necessary to print and play games. I think he can correct me if I'm wrong because I don't want to misrepresent him, but I think he would like more people to be doing the print and play thing. I think he'd like print and play to be more of a thing than it is and more people to be capable of doing that. So his license for that game specifically says, you can create this, you can print this, but I want you to do everything.
You can't yourself. Take it to your print shop.
You don't have someone else make it for you. I want you to do it yourself. I want you to get the equipment. I want you to learn how to use it. And once you've done my game, then you'll be able to do more games. And I think that, in a sense, actually does grow the whole 18XX community.
Yeah, and I think he has absolute right to do that. I think the designer or the creator always has the right to license it in any way they choose, even though we might not agree with it or I might not agree with it. It's completely up to them. They're allowed to do with it what they
absolutely.
Want.
Absolutely. If you make something and you put it out in the world and you want to put conditions on it, then go for it.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think you do that knowing that that's not a hard condition to circumvent, right?
And also that you might be limiting your audience.
Yeah, for sure. But I think ultimately, people
are either it's your decision. It is.
Listen to it or not listen to it. I mean, I don't think he's going to sue people for printing at a print shop. But the idea of it was, hey, I want more people to be able to do this thing or know how to do this thing.
Yeah,
so I think people have I also think he just designs it for the enjoyment of designing a game. He's obviously very deeply invested in that genre. But so I think some people do it for profit. Some people do it for passion. Some people do it for both. And I think, like you say, I mean, whatever reason you might design a game is, I don't think we could criticize any of it, really.
But it's an interesting topic for sure.
Sorry, that was a bit of a long diversion, but I thought it was an interesting conversation that came up. I think in terms of the Kickstarter stuff, I think I'm very on board with all the mass-produced stuff. I think it's great. I think All Aboard Games expanding and doing the mass-produced stuff is great. Sure, as much as I'd like to have full access to their catalogs and all of that kind of stuff, I think that you are getting games in way more hands this way. Kickstarter is an insane marketing tool. For 1861-67, which is not, I mean, it's not an obscure 18XX, but I mean, it's not like one of these well-known ones that everyone talks about, like 1830 or 1889. It's just one of these games, right? It's one of many 18XXs. For that to sell over 2,000 copies, it's insane. How many handmade copies of, like, I don't know, take something popular like 1889. Did All Aboard Games sell in the similar 1 month period ever? Guarantee you not 2,000. So I just think it gets way more copies into way more hands. You cannot underestimate the marketing power of Kickstarter, especially in the board game community. So I think it's a net positive for all of us who are interested in this genre, really.
Yeah, I agree.
I'm on board with that, but I understand why some people might be upset about the way it impacts them personally. But I think big picture, it's a good thing. Okay, should we talk about some mail?
Okay, cool.
That right there is the mail. Now let's talk about the mail. Can we talk about the mail, please, Mac? I'm dying to talk about the mail with you all day, okay?
We got an email from Mark, and the subject line was the tragedy of American rugby.
Oh, because you said last time you weren't sure if they were in the World Cup.
I remembered the US, because I said that, but I was like, no, they were. I remember them having a team, but I didn't follow that group at all. I was mostly focused on our games and our groups and stuff, and then who we were potentially going to play against, stuff like that. But yeah, apparently they are called the Eagles, but that they're pretty weak on the 15 circuits. They didn't make it out of pool play in the Rugby World Cup.
Okay.
To the surprise of no one. they said, we occasionally do okay in a sevens tournament. You know rugby sevens?
It's smaller teams.
Yeah, man. And it's like 7 minutes a half.
Okay. So it's kind of like...
It's 7-on-7 and it's basically just all running. It's actually pretty entertaining. It's like T20 in cricket. Another obscure sport that only the Commonwealth countries are going to know or whatever. But he was just saying, in terms of rugby in the States, most players in the US, including him, start playing in university after playing other sports in their youth. It's difficult to compete with nations that start the kids with a rugby ball in the crib. Yeah, fair enough.
I guess American football is more popular there. And baseball,
I think it's very obscure. I mean, I don't think much is played on the school level and stuff like that at all. There's probably some rugby clubs or things like that.
Whereas in our schools, rugby is like
massive,
big between schools. Yeah,
yeah. So you'll get rugby scholarships and things like that to go to different schools.
Yeah.
So he said, topic scaling with different player counts. Dan and I are playing 1889 online. I'm about to bring out the Diesels and Rusters 4 train. Dan, if you're hearing this, I hope it went okay for you, man. But they were playing a 4-player game. They said they're finding it rather different than 3, which they imagine will be quite different to 6. So, yeah, scaling, player count scaling is actually something that has kind of come into my orbit recently. I feel like there's been a couple of discussions about it. We spoke about in the context of 1830 about how different, for example, a 6-player game is in terms of the general flow of things, where you won't be able to just start this company low, start my second company high to fund my first company. That's the general loop. But a 6-player game is just not going to happen because there just aren't enough companies to go around. Maybe for one or two people they could do it, but the rest not. I think player count scaling is kind of interesting in the context of regular board games. It's just like, is it any good at this player count? Whereas 18XX, it seems to oftentimes fundamentally change the way the game is played.
Yes, it's interesting because if you look in most 18XXs that I've played, the number of corporations stays the same regardless of player count. So if you were to look at the map in an 18XX, I don't think I would be able to tell how many players played that map, because the development of the board is the same roughly, because it's the same number of corporations having an effect on the player board. Whereas in other board games, it might be very different.
Yeah, that's true. So in terms of that kind of development of the board and stuff, it looks the same.
Yeah.
But in terms of your opportunities as a player,
it can be that's quite different. So the way that the players play the game would be different. But the way the corporations go, maybe not so much. I don't know.
Yeah. So it is quite interesting. And I think there's a lot of nuance there. Well, there always is with this stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, they were talking about 1849 being incredibly fragile with 5 players and being very easy, a miserable experience.
Yeah, I think the big thing would be like corporations divided by number of players. Like, what's the average number of corporations each player can expect to float?
Right.
And if it's something like 1.5, then there will be quite a race to be one of the first or one of the players to get to float that second company.
Well, in 49, it would be 1.2.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's probably a lot to consider in terms of how that impacts your capitalization, how you manage your finances, how you manage the train rush with 5 people. I've heard it's not great. Other people just say it's very fragile, which maybe is a nice way of saying that it probably won't be great, but it could be decent.
Right.
And they were talking about 1889 as well, which is the one Mark is talking about here. At 5 players, that it often becomes a problem that the 6 train is not bought and the 3s don't get rested. There's this thing where it can be very easily for the people who want to buy the 6 to be train locked and the people who then have the space to buy the 6 train.
Have the capital,
or are just massively not incentivized to do so.
Right.
So 3 trains will run until the end is apparently something that can happen quite commonly in a 5-player game.
Interesting.
Which is something we experienced in our 2-player game, right? Which was interesting as well. So they were talking about the $1 3 train, in that oftentimes what happens is that one player will try and entice someone else to buy their 3 train for $1 just to open up a train slot for them.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so this is the kind of 18XX shorthand you see, though. Someone will be like, oh yeah, it'll be about the $1 3 train. And you're like, what is the $1 3 train? Yeah. You know? So I'm sort of talking about chess, and someone's like, the Queen's Gambit. And you're like, okay, what the hell is that? But yeah, apparently this is kind of a common occurrence with that. And a lot of the game is actually about managing that. Once you know that, it becomes about managing your slots.
Okay.
And preparing for that eventuality and trying to not put yourself in that position where you need to buy the train, but you can't.
Interesting.
Yeah. So scaling is actually a pretty complex,
complex
thing that we probably can't easily answer or don't really have the knowledge to answer very well, but certainly something to consider. So I'd say that I guess my only advice would be to actually consider it.
So yeah, I don't think I know the 18XX games well enough to necessarily well, or foresee how our player count might affect a play.
Yeah, but I think there's the big stuff, like number of corporations is big, certificate limit is big, and the impact of those two things can be pretty big.
Yeah,
so I think when you sit down for a game at a weird player count, try and think about maybe how it might be impacting the play.
And the one that I do see, it's kind of the game trying to scale it frequently, is by player starting money.
Yeah,
that's something that sometimes changes depending on player count. That and the bank size can also sometimes change.
Yeah, I think most often player money and certificate limit are the two things that change.
Right.
Because generally with player money, there's a fixed amount that's divided between
X number of players.
So less players, more money. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But what's interesting about 89 as well is that when the certificate limit is really low, the question becomes whether you want that private that never closes.
Right, yeah. Because that takes up a cert slot, which...
takes up a slot, and it only generates revenue. And revenue's great, but is it going to generate more than you can get from stock appreciation? Yeah.
And in early game, it is, but in late game, it's not.
Yeah.
So it's a trade-off, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So you might not want to get stuck with that, because in early game, it actually hinders you by being so damn expensive that you can't float a company until the second or third stock round anyway.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Interesting.
Mm.
So thanks, Mark, for that. Oh, so Brian asked us, do we have any thoughts on poker chips? Oh, boy. So poker chips...
We like them.
Yeah. So, yeah, he definitely plays with poker chips already. So he says, are there particular denominations, colors, materials that you prefer? Is it different in poker than in 18XX? How much importance do you place on your poker chips, if any? And obviously, this is all very subjective.
It is very subjective. So... maybe we made poker chips. You found a breakdown of denominations for us online somewhere.
I
had an old poker set available, and we kind of just had someone design and print labels for us, stickers that we stuck on with kind of like a train icon type thing and the denominations. The one thing I will say about poker chips, for me personally, for both poker and any kind of gaming, I don't think you ever want a poker chip that's double the previous denomination. Like, you don't want a 10 and a 20. Because for me, the fewer denominations you have, the better, because there's less confusion, less clashing with colors. Because some things to take into account, like blue and black poker chips can look very, very similar, especially in low light conditions if you don't have very good lighting. And there are other colors that clash as well. So if you can keep the number of colors down, that's a good thing. So in other words, the number of denominations down. So for me, a good rule of thumb is poker chip Y should be 4 or 5 times poker chip X. So if you have a 1, then have a 5. If you have a 5, either have a 20 or a 25. If you have a 20 or a 25, then have 100, you know. So I think the main variable there is 20 and 25. I think everyone can agree on the 1s, the 5s, and the 100s.
All right.
But I would not, for example, have a 20 and a 50. That to me, like, the 50 is taking up 225 chips worth of space. It's not worth it.
And I think that's good advice. Be wary of the too many denominations trap.
Yeah.
It feels like it's easier, but in practice, it's actually not.
Yeah.
It's actually more of a pain in the ass to have multiple denominations all the time.
Yeah.
And multiple colors to track. The ones we use are 1, 5, 20, 50, 100, 500. That's been perfect for us.
And so the 500s we only really use to supplement the size of the bank.
Absolutely, yeah.
Like, we have, what is it, like 6,500 worth of hundreds and lower. And then if a game needs more, we add a few 500s.
Which is a cool thing to do, to set up your chipset in a way that everything except like a big number like 500, you know exactly what amount it is. Because counting out chips every game is a pain.
Yeah.
So we take out our entire chipset and we know that without the 500s, it equals 6,500.
Yeah.
And then we just add 500s as we need to. So if the bank is 11,000, we just chuck in 500s until we get to that point.
Yes.
And then later on, when the money becomes a lot and you have all this extra cash, you can start trading in your hundreds for 500s or whatever.
Yeah.
But that works fine. In terms of actual chip, I think it really just comes down to preference. People go really, 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 really deep on poker chips. There's lots of recommendations around what's good and what's not. That's often quite America-focused, which I think you're not from America. And that can be hard if you're not from there. You don't want to ship special chips from overseas or something like that. So I think it's going to be very dependent on what's available in your area.
Yeah.
I think you just want something that's comfortable enough to use. It feels okay. It's not like too slippery or sliding in everywhere.
Yeah.
I think as long as it's decent quality, it's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing, the thing that has a good quality feel is weight to them. You get chips that are purely just plastic and they're very light. And I mean, that's still better than paper money.
If yeah.
that's all you can get, take them. The ones we have are 11 grams each. They were a big poker set that I bought ages ago. And they have a nice like feel to them because of the added weight. And they, but they're still, like, I wouldn't say they're super good quality. They're actually literally like plastic chips with a metal disc inside each of them to get them up to 11 grams. And then you can go full on clay chips, which are yeah. very expensive, which for 18XX, I don't know, maybe.
Yeah, ultimately it depends what you want to spend and what you yeah. want. But I think as long as they feel comfortable for you, I'd say get something that is just reasonably thick. Like, you don't want those very, very thin ones. And you want to have edge spots. So you want to have those sort of like stripes down the side. It makes it way easier to count when you're looking at them sideways.
Yeah. Or, yeah.
Than
or,
the ones that are blank.
Or be able to tell that there's a misplaced chip in a stack or something.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Mm. That's probably pretty important. And just reasonably thick and comfortable. Yeah. I don't think you can go super wrong.
No.
In terms of distribution, maybe we can put the links in the show notes. There's two that I think are good. There's this one that I found online that we based off of, which I think is a really nice distribution.
It works well.
It's also a really long article on poker chips in general that you can read if you want to, but it's got a distribution in there that will work for most like normal sized 18XX games. And then also on JC Lawrence's profile on Board Game Geek, he's got a huge poker chip thing there as well. But he's got a distribution, a 391 chip distribution that works for pretty much all games as well.
Okay.
And that's convenient. So I think we'll throw those two links in there that you can have a look at. I think the most important thing to get right is the distribution.
Yeah.
In terms of actual chips, I don't think it matters too much. Just get colors that make sense for you and chips that feel comfortable for you.
Yeah.
I think you're not going to be totally miserable with anything, really.
No.
Unless it's really important to you.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think you'll be okay.
Yeah.
Like I say, debates rage on for ages around poker chips and whether you should oil them or not, or whether to have denominations or not. You can have undenominated. It's actually not a big deal. You just put a little card there with the denominations, or you just tell people the denominations. It's actually really easy to remember five denominations for colors. It's not hard. So don't stress too much about that. I think it's fine either way.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's it.
Yeah.
But we'll put those links up because I think getting the distribution right is the most important thing by far.
Yes.
Because that's something that if you screw up, you'll be miserable
because
you'll keep having to chip up, or you won't have enough fives or whatever the case may be.
Yeah, and have a lot of the smaller denominations.
Yeah.
Like it's very easy to have a lot of the hundreds because that makes your bank very big, but it's more of a pain if you have too few ones than it is if you have too few hundreds.
Yeah, exactly. Just keep it simple.
Yeah.
Sweet. Okay, but thanks for the question because I think it's something that people ask a lot. We might have actually spoken about it before, but I'm going to chuck those links, or we can chuck those links in the description just so you guys have that as well, because I think those are the two good resources that I've come across that make it pretty easy.
Yeah.
We got an email from Lachlan. So Lachlan was the guy who made that 18 Dracula game. I don't know if you've seen that floating around. I think you have, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm actually keen to give that a try. It seems like quite an easy print and play because there's no track tiles, which I think is the real pain when it comes to print and plays.
For cutting, yes.
Yeah, so it's got a different track system and things like that. So I'm keen to give that a try. So I think you can probably Google that and you might probably find a reference to it. Yeah, but he just said, "Hello, friends. I just want to let you know that I've been appreciating the podcast. I found it a month or so back and I've been listening to each episode within a day or two of it coming out. It's been part of my dive into 18XX, which has only started a few months back." Another,
oh, cool.
Another sheep into the fold. Yeah, no. I always like, we've gotten so many emails there from people who are like, "Yeah, I just discovered this whole genre or whatever," which is awesome because I think that's what we kind of aimed at in the beginning.
Yes, yeah.
But it's just cool that so many people are discovering these games. Only one game in person, but quite a few online. And were it not for those online games and your podcast more than most, I wouldn't have gone down the 18 Dracula designing route.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So that's cool. I'm keen to give that a try.
Yeah.
And then Elliot sent us an email with the catchy title, General Feedback Nonsense. Yeah, so this is quite a long one, but I'll try to give you the highlights. So he says, I'm writing this as a person who hasn't actually ever played an 18XX game, but has ordered a few of them and has been obsessing over them during the entire waiting period. Yo, I've been there, Elliot. Not with 18XX. Fred just dropped that into my life with 1846. but I've definitely had that thing where you're just dying to play a game and yeah. It's like...
You're reading about it.
Yeah, reading about it, watching videos.
Yeah.
So he says he's been playing board games for a few years, but in the last year he's been itching for more and more heavy titles, which I think is the way we went.
Yes.
I mean, I think when we first started playing board games together, we played some really light stuff.
Mm.
And then at some point it was just heavier and heavier Euros. And then it was just nothing but heavy Euros before we added 18XX to the mix.
Yeah.
I mostly play two-player games with my partner, but semi-regularly with a small group. So anything I buy and play has to at least work with two players. And as such, I've gone in for 18 Chesapeake and 1862, and I recently received a copy of 1825 Unit 1. So I don't know what the deal is with 1825. It's a pretty small game, but there's Unit 1 and Unit 2.
Oh.
I don't know what the difference is, but he says BGG Hivemind would tell you the much more expensive Unit 2 was the better choice. Oh, of course they would, but hopefully you like it anyway, Elliot. You know what? I think when you're new, everything's amazing, which is nice. I think, that's what happened with board games. I remember when I first started playing board games, they were all good, man. Now I'm like such a snob. Like, oh, this is terrible.
Yeah, that should just be about whether you're having a good time or not. Not what other people think
exactly,
about
it. Exactly, but it's become harder to have a good time with age, man. I'm telling you, you become more of a curmudgeon by the day. Not you, me, the royal you. but he says, anyway, the point of this is to tell you over the last month, I've been on something of a derailed 18XX binge, along with watching various playthroughs and videos on the topic. And I found the two of you endlessly entertaining. I'm going to read this email to my wife.
Yeah.
He said, your thoughts on two-player 18XX have given me a lot of perspective to make more informed choices and really helped me understand what I want out of these games and how to go about getting them. So, yeah, I think that you've got two good choices there. Chesapeake, I think, is pretty much was in the sort of thing that it's designed to be played at two. And it's kind of a similar vein to something like 89, where I think it's a smaller map with an 1830-ish rule set. So I imagine it'll be pretty good. I think you'll enjoy it. We've really enjoyed 89 with two. Yes. So I imagine it will be kind of similar. And I think if it's been designed with two in mind, which it seems like it has been, then I think you'll dig it. I think it's going to be a good choice.
Yeah.
1862 has this insane player count of like 1 to 6 or 1 to... No, I think it goes up to like 7 or 8. Oh, wow. I don't know. It goes up to some insane number, maybe 7.
The Caverna of 18XX.
Yeah, exactly. And it's got a solo mode. I think two player is going to be cool. I don't know. I think maybe they've got like a two player variant in there. That one's also on its way to me, or it should be now eventually. They had a printing error that they were fixing. Mm. But yeah, I'm keen to try that. I think that's just a bit of a wacky one in general.
Okay.
So just a heads up for you, Elliot, that one may be a little bit like overwhelming for your first one. Maybe try play. You're going to get 62 before Chesapeake, though. So I don't know. Go for it, man. See how it works out. But just expect it. From what I've read about it, it's pretty different to your kind of standard 18XX experience. So
yeah.
And he just said, thanks so much. He always looks forward to a new episode popping up. And he says, P.S. My supervisor at work is from Joburg.
Oh, no way.
And during the episode where you talked about phrases and language usage in South Africa, I had a good laugh because it reminded me of a time when she warned us at a crossing that the robot was about to change.
Yeah, robot is one of those. We did talk about it, one of those things that the rest of the world doesn't know what we're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's one of my favorite ones because it just makes us sound so third world.
Yes, yeah.
Like this thing that changes light color is like robotics for us. You know what I mean? Like, this is insane. And he just added he's actually from Australia, but he was born in Wales.
Ah, okay.
Ooh, you know what we forgot, Fred? We forgot about our new patrons.
Yes.
So we just want to thank you guys a lot. We have two new patrons. We have Kendall, who sent us that long email we were chatting about last week.
Yes, which I've read, and it was really nice, Kendall. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
Good to get that kind of feedback, yeah.
And then also Michael Mahoney as well.
Mm.
So thanks, Michael. But both of you guys are in the upper tier, the Discord tier. But we don't have you on Discord. So just give us a shout. We don't know if it's not working or if you just don't use Discord and don't care, but we'd love to have you join the the channel.
Yeah, so if you have any trouble joining Discord, just email us or something.
Someone just joined, Fred.
Oh.
Half an hour ago. Is this a new person or is this Kendall/Michael? Okay, so we did some detective work that was removed to the power of editing. And it seems that the person who just joined the Discord is not a new person. So it's either Kendall or Michael. So whichever one of you has not joined, then please give us a shout so we can get you added to the Discord, because it'll be sweet to hang out.
Yeah.
Sweet. So should we move on to our topic, even though we've killed a lot of time talking about non-topic stuff?
Yeah, sure.
But we thought we could discuss briefly this week anyway. Briefly because I'd say we're not really experts. We've got a couple of plays in of Irish gauge.
Yes.
And we thought it'd be fun to talk about. I think that as soon as you get into 18XX, you start to like develop this weird appreciation for all train games.
Yeah.
Well, that's how I am anyway. And I think these Winsome train games are part of the 18XX family.
Mm.
Kind of thing, like, you know, second cousins or something.
Yeah.
So yeah, how would we describe these? I mean, I don't know if they actually are. I haven't played a lot of them, so they generally call these cube rails games, I believe, and I think Irish Gauge forms part of that.
Okay.
I don't know how similar they all are to each other. I don't know if the separation is similar to an 18XX kind of separation. I suspect that it is, that the general flow is kind of the same. But anyway, I believe that to be true. So stuff like Chicago Express and things like that, they operate in a similar kind of way. So the general gist is that it's similar to 18XX, but a much more stripped down experience, in that there's stocks that you can buy and track, essentially, that you can build.
Yeah.
You operate as a player, though, rather than a company. Yes. You can just operate within the interests of whatever companies you have some stake in.
Yeah.
So in Irish Gauge, for example, there are six different companies. So let's say I have a share in the orange company and a share in the blue company. On my turn, I can build track essentially for either the orange company or the blue company.
Yeah,
so basically on your turn, it's a very easy game. You have one of four options. You can build track, which is basically laying down these little trains on hexes to kind of create routes. So those can stop in either cities or towns. You can call for dividends, which is basically you pull three cubes out of the bag. They can be one of three different colors, pink, black, or white. And then let's say you pull out two pink cubes and a black cube, then the pink cities and the black cities will score.
Right.
So then you look at your routes and you see how many black and pink cities you have on them, how many towns you have on them. You add up those numbers and then you pay dividends. So I'll go back to that in a second. The other thing you can do is put up one of the shares for auction. So you don't get to just outright buy a share. You can say, I'd like to auction this blue share. And then what happens is you set the starting price. It has a face value that'll be worth at the end of the game. There's no stock appreciation. So you get dividends from shares, but they don't go up in value.
Right.
They have a fixed value. And there'll be four blue shares, and the first one is the least expensive, and they get more expensive as you go down.
Yeah.
They don't all have four. Like the orange company only has two, for example. But you start the bidding, and then everyone bids, and highest bidder takes it, essentially. And the last thing you can do is to turn a town into a city of a particular color. Pretty simple. In terms of the laying track, you have like action points that you can kind of spend. So building on empty normal terrain costs less points than building on occupied terrain or difficult terrain, so to speak,
like river or something.
And that is basically it. The game starts with an auction where you auction off the first of each color share, and then you take it from there. So it's very, very simple in its rules, which is kind of cool, because it gives you that sort of 18XX-y kind of experience. But you can play this with people who don't really play a lot of board games. You can play it with your regular group.
It's also fairly quick playing.
It doesn't take very long. It could be in over as little as 30 minutes, but maybe like 45 minutes on average, something like that. It's a quick game. It's a very, very quick game. It's almost like a filler, but it's pretty meaty. So here we've had two plays of this game, and our first game was really, really close, and our second game
you just ran away with it.
A huge, huge, huge margin. And I think every time we play this game, I feel like there's something new to kind of consider. There's like a weird nuance, and there's kind of things that are hard to wrap your head around. I think coming from 18XX, one of the hardest things to wrap your head around is that more shares do not mean more dividends. for you.
Yeah, so I don't think you mentioned this, but if a company has three dividends or three shares and only one share is in a player's hand, the other two are still in IPO, if you want to call it that, and it pays five per dividend or five per share, well, if it pays a $5 dividend, the player with the one share will get all $5. Yeah. And then if someone else buys a share, now that $5 will be split between the two shareholders.
Yeah, so there's no like bank.
Yeah.
So if you imagine in a regular 18xx game, if you had 50% of a company, you'd get 50% of its root.
Mm.
In this, if you own only one share, but no one else owns any others, you get 100% of its root.
Which is very interesting. Yeah.
So it's a weird situation. So we were playing and Rudy wanted to auction off. So Rudy had, let's say, I can't remember what color it was, the yellow company. And he had one share of yellow.
And no one else had it.
No one else had it. And he put up the second yellow share for auction. And I said, well, you shouldn't do that. Yeah. That's a mistake because you have zero incentive to buying that share unless someone else is trying to buy it.
Yeah.
So putting it up for auction is just essentially putting yourself at risk.
Because he is getting, before he does that, he's getting 100% of the yellow payout.
Right.
By putting up a second share for auction, he's now risking reducing his payout to 50% if he doesn't win that auction of that second share.
And the second share of a company you own has a lot more value for you potentially than the player who's buying it.
Well, if he wins that auction, he still only gets 100%.
Oh, yes. No. Yeah, that I'm saying is a mistake. But let's say Simon puts up his yellow share for auction.
Yeah.
And that share is worth $10. Is it worth more to Rudy than it is to Simon? Simon's going to get 50% of a revenue.
Yeah.
Rudy, if he buys it, isn't going to increase his revenue, but he's going to defend his revenue. I don't know. It's
interesting. Yeah.
So that's actually hard to say. Maybe I guess it has equal value to both of them in that sense, but you kind of want to defend your own shares, especially if it's a very good route.
Yeah.
So I essentially won that game by snowballing one company and me having the only share in that company.
Mm.
I was allowed to get dividends for it a couple of times and it had big dividends. I set up a very good route for it very early on and no one else had auctioned it. And then when someone did auction it, I think I bought that share because I had so much money.
Yeah.
So if you get a very early big money lead in this game, you can snowball it by just buying more shares
and
getting ahead of people.
Yeah. And the other thing that I found very interesting about this game is as the shares get auctioned, so you can, there's not a fixed dividend payment. It's a player chooses, let's pay dividends, and that pays dividends for everyone.
Yes.
It's not like if I call a dividend payment, only I'm the only one to benefit from it. It's everyone can potentially benefit from that. So players' money decreases when they buy shares, obviously, and it doesn't increase until someone calls for a dividend payment. So you can get to a stage in the game where, let's say I'm the only one who hasn't bought a share recently. Now, but everyone else has paid money to buy shares. Now, I have the most money and I have, let's say, $13. I can put up a share for auction for $13 knowing that no one else can match me on that at all. So I can guarantee myself that share purchase, which is very interesting. But now then I'm low on money again and it's even again.
Yeah, that's the thing. You can definitely manipulate things to the point where you can just have whatever you want, right? If you have the money and other people don't, you can take whatever you want and no one can stop you.
You can choose which share you buy because no one else has the money to defend.
Which is something I realized in our second game. So in our first game, we did the first auction. I think I came third in our first game. We did the first auction and I wanted to come out with more shares than anyone else. That was my goal. Because I looked at it and there's six starting shares and four players, right? So if I had two shares out of the starting auction, that means I was ahead of everyone else in my mind. So then I think I did come out with two shares. But the problem with that is then you have no money.
Yeah.
And then people can see kind of how the board looks and put up a share for auction that's more attractive.
Mm. Mm.
You almost get to pick whatever share you want with more information if you hold back in the initial auction.
Right.
The detriment of that being that if someone calls for dividends, you're getting less dividends than someone who has two shares already.
The other downside to starting with two shares is because you operate as a player, you can only build track for one of those two companies. So you're not, your second share isn't gaining anything. It will not pay a dividend if someone calls a dividend early.
Yeah, exactly. Or you have two like neutered routes instead of one really strong one.
Right.
So in this game, I started with red and only red and I just focused everything into red.
Mm.
Actually, I didn't start with only red. I actually had blue or something as well, I think. And Simon had blue as well. And I was just like,
Blue's
I'm
only
sharing
worth,
with him, so yeah. he can do that company if he wants to.
Yeah.
I'm going to focus on red.
Mm.
So the interesting thing, like you're saying, is both the auction and the dividend is actually for all players.
Yeah.
So you are giving up your entire turn for something that benefits everyone else.
Yeah.
So you have to manipulate the situation to the fact that it benefits you the most.
Mm.
If you call for dividends and someone else gets more money than you, you kind of screwed up pretty badly.
Yeah.
You gave up your action to give someone else a better advantage than you.
Yes.
That's actually a major cock up.
Yeah, that's a big benefit to them, yeah.
And that's what happened in our game. I spent all my actions on developing Red's Railway to the fact that it had like it had all the colors, it had crazy value routes, and other people called dividends for me early on.
Yeah.
So I just thought I'll wait for someone else to do it because when they do, I'll have more money than them and then I can manipulate the auction.
Yeah.
So it's this weird kind of game of chicken
going
on in a sense, right?
Yeah, and it's very similar with putting up a share for auction because you could also, if you lose that auction, you've just given up a turn without doing anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's the worst. When you put up a share for auction and someone else outbids you, you basically just gave away your turn.
I don't know if it's the worst because you might just be wanting to flush money out of someone else's hand so that you could put the share you really want up for auction and then not have money. But then they could call a dividend in between.
But buying a share on someone else's turn feels amazing.
Oh, yeah.
It feels like you got a free action, essentially.
It does, yeah.
You got to do something on someone else's turn and they didn't do anything on their turn.
Yeah.
So it feels so good when you do that. And it's weird because then it almost like when I buy a share on someone else's turn, I almost want to pay more for it.
Yeah.
It because feels like it has not higher value to me.
I think it does because it doesn't cost you an action.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's so worthwhile. Like I get to have an extra share and then when it comes to my turn, I get to have my turn.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. Those action choices are interesting.
So it's one of these games that really thrives on a metagame. That's we had this whole conversation afterwards, this big long debate about like luck in the game and like openings, I guess you could call it.
Mm.
So like the starting positions are fixed.
Right.
So they're going to be very similar every game. So that red company could have that same good start again.
Yes.
But my point was if everyone thinks the red company is good, and everyone overpays the red company in the initial auction.
Yeah, because it's an auction. So now that we all know, I don't know if we know it, but we think we know that red is the best. Now we're willing to pay more for red at the beginning.
And turn order is so important as well, right? Because red actually starts on the same hex or right next to another company. If that company acts before red, the player who controls the company acts before red, they can block red's amazing opening route entirely. Mm. So then player order and who owns what company totally changes the value of that company.
Yeah.
It's part of why I wanted the red company because I was first.
Right.
So I looked at that and I thought, Simon's got the blue company, but I've got the red and I'm going before him. So I get to build that railway first.
Yeah.
Because in this game, there's difficult terrain, which is harder to build on. But if someone else is in difficult terrain, you can't build on it at all.
Right.
Only one person can occupy difficult terrain hex. And this starting position has a place where you can just smoothly block off that route from, and they have to go a different way.
Right.
So me starting first changed the value of that for me completely.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's one of these games that I really like where it's totally dependent on reacting to other people and like perceived value.
Mm.
The value is not set in stone.
Yeah.
It's how much are you willing to pay for it? There's auctions, there's who's going to act first, who else owns this company. Owning one share of a bad company that no one else owns is much better than owning one share of a good company that two other people own.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very interesting game, actually. Yeah.
Which is very different from 18XX, right? Where you just want to have shares in the best companies most of the time. But in this game, because of the weird way the dividend payouts work, just having been the only person with a share means that you're getting way more.
Yeah.
So let's say your route runs for 6 and their route runs for 15.
Mm.
If there's a split three ways, you get more money than they do.
Yeah.
They get 5 each, you get 6.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's very, very different to 18XX in that way. And you have to kind of like throw out some of your 18XX bias or ways of thinking when you play it.
Yeah.
But it's cool because it gives you that same feeling of like stocks and auctions and yeah, a bit of money manipulation stuff.
Yeah.
It's very, very cool.
Yeah, it's an interesting game.
So I think in terms of like the deeper strategy stuff, I think that we are...
Oh, we have a lot to learn, beyond. I think.
We played a game of Age of Steam before that, which we'll talk about at some point because that was a really good game as well. But also we were just like, we are so out of our depth here.
Yeah. I was so broke in that game.
Do you want to tell them what actually happened at Age of Steam?
That I went bankrupt.
In the first round.
In the first round, yeah.
Yeah, so in Age of Steam, you can go bankrupt and...
be out of the game.
Be out of the game. And we didn't know how easy this was to happen or whatever, but essentially you have to like pay these debts, and if you go past zero on the score tracker, if you go back down to zero, you go bankrupt. So in the first round, Simon messed with Fred's company or his plans.
Mm.
Fred had taken some bonds, and then we were like, oh, I'm out, guys. So we actually had to rewind some stuff because we're like, we're not going to play this whole game without you. So we actually rewound
some stuff. Well, I had built some track which costs money, which you allowed me to take back.
Yes,
and then I had enough money
that
to...
It was an easy fix, yeah.
It was an easy fix. That allowed me to still be in the game, but it wasn't a good game for me. I was still broke the whole game through.
But that was the thing. Hey, almost it would have been like a mercy probably to be bankrupted, because you actually just...
I was taking out new bonds every game to be able to pay my bonds.
Yeah, basically, every single round you were just issuing more
every
bonds.
Every round, yeah.
And it was just pointless for you essentially, which I think kind of sucked for you probably, because you knew from round one you actually had no hope of winning.
Mm.
Probably from like round two when you realized you were just literally... working to paying off your debts. That was it.
Yeah.
You never actually advance on that score track. And then eventually did go bankrupt in like round seven or whatever.
Yeah. Close
like
to the end.
The second
last
round.
Yeah, I didn't feel like there was a way for me to catch up. But yeah. I don't know.
Who knows?
I could have just played badly.
Yeah, but, and that game has kind of this like little bit of a luck element with the dice roll thing. And that was annoying me. But then afterwards I was like, you know what? Yes, I got screwed by the dice, but also yes, there's like 10,000 things I could have done better.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to be that upset about like a role not going your way or something. Because it's just like, but there's so much I could have done differently that would have put me in a way better position regardless. So I think if you bank everything on the dice roll, you can't get that upset when it doesn't go your way, you know?
Yeah,
which is kind of interesting. It's always interesting to me when I see like a dice roll or some luck, little bit of a luck element in these games.
Because,
you know, train games are like all like low luck.
Mm.
Open information, blah, blah, blah. Like, it's those types of gamers are the type of people who play these games.
Yeah.
So whenever I look at them, I'm like, if I feel like I got screwed, there's probably a way I could have mitigated it, because the type of people who play these games aren't the type of people who stand for just getting totally screwed by luck.
Yeah. Yeah. Irish Gauge has a little bit of a luck factor as well, where you draw cubes for to see which companies pay dividends. But the thing there is all those cubes will be drawn by the end of the game. That's the end game trigger.
Yeah.
So you know all the cubes are going to come out. So it is there's a little bit of luck in which order they come out.
Right.
But yeah.
Yeah, so not which companies, which color cities pay.
Right.
All the companies pay.
All the companies pay, yes. Yeah. Sorry, yeah.
But it's interesting because you kind of have this choice, right? So you can connect to like three black cities, and then if a black cube comes out, all those black cities are going to pay, and you're going to get a huge payout. Or you can connect to one of each.
Yeah.
So that regardless of what colors come out, you're definitely going to get paid, but you're going to get paid less
than
if you'd went all in on one color.
Yeah.
You can also manipulate the bag to some extent, because you can change the color of cities, or you can create colored cities.
Yeah.
Which is interesting, because that cube comes from the bag that pays you dividends.
Yes. So you're reducing the chances of it paying, but increasing the amount that it'll pay when it comes. Yeah.
Yeah. And I do wonder if there's some way of using that aggressively. So if you own three blue shares and I own one blue share, can I just start...
I think so.
Placing a ton of white cubes in your blue towns, because towns always pay. Those are the cities without cubes. Can I just kind of screw you over like that?
I think so. I think that's like I was thinking about it after our play. I think that is the actual way to use that action of creating a city out of a town is as an attack rather than trying to improve your own payment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there's ways it could kind of almost be both. I don't know, like where it kind of helps your route because you need a white cube, but this other person has two white cubes already, and you just give them another one to sort of like
minimize
their thing.
I think what you should look at there is, I can't remember the color cubes, but let's say red is more beneficial to me than to you.
Right.
Then I should be creating towns that aren't red.
Yes.
So that you get paid less of the colors that help you more than they help me. And also my chances of red paying is greater.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting.
Mm, it is. Yeah.
It is. There's a lot actually to that game. It's got a very simple rule set, but I think there's a lot of room for wangling. And I think there's a lot of metagame stuff that can happen where perceived value of things is going to totally change their actual real value in the game. Cool. Okay, we should probably try and shuffle along towards the end.
Okay,
I don't know how
sure,
long we've been talking for, but I think this is a long one. We can do a quick South African topic before we go. You had one for us.
Oh, yes. So I came across this Reddit post where someone said something about TV licenses. And a lot of people were like, what are TV licenses?
Yeah.
So that is something that we have that I never really thought about. But when you think about it, not many countries do have that. I don't know which ones do, but America doesn't. America has like cable, kind of TV and things. But over here, we have TV licenses, which is basically a license you have to pay for every year, which allows you to watch the public broadcast television as well as radio. So radio is also covered in that. And if you go and buy a new TV, you have to show them your valid TV license or get one right then and there.
Yeah, so it's kind of weird. So basically what it is that there are three channels that you can get for free that are the government broadcasting thing, right? A whopping three channels. As you can imagine, they all suck. So this is like a real grudge thing for many people. A lot of people try and not pay it like out of principle or like some act of protest. It is a really tiny amount of money though. So it's about $15 a year, I think about $15, maybe less than $15. It's like 200 and something bucks there. It's a really, really low amount of money, all things considered, right? But maybe to some people, not that low amount of money. But yeah.
For me, it's not about the amount of money so much as it is the inconvenience and ridiculousness.
It's the principle.
Of like having to take the time every year to go and buy this license.
Right. So, I mean, these days, I don't know, I just pay it online or whatever. So it's a lot easier than it used to be. But so it's kind of funny. So basically, there's these three channels and you can get them on any TV. You just plug in like bunny ears or whatever, like any antenna, and you'll pick up these three channels. So their argument is basically because you have a TV that's capable of receiving these channels,
you have to pay
for them.
Yeah.
The truth is a lot of the people who pay this TV license never, ever watch these channels.
No.
I never watch them. I don't even have them.
No, me neither. My TV is not plugged into an aerial. It's plugged into internet and I watch Netflix.
Well, that is the reality, for a lot of people these days, is that everything I do on my TV is streamed.
Yeah.
I have no non-streaming television, essentially. Nothing hardwired. We don't have anything like cable. We have satellite TV, but we don't have cable anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. And these three channels, I don't even know how to get them at this point.
Yeah. Yeah.
Other than sticking some bunny ears into my TV, right?
Yeah.
So, it's kind of a funny thing. It's like a big point of contention, though.
It is.
It's just this thing that everyone grumbles about. Like, if you just bring up TV license, ugh.
Yeah.
TV license, such a scam. Stealing from us, you know, like, whatever.
Yeah.
Just bring it up at a brow or something.
I think the reason people are unhappy with it is because it is pretty much forced on everyone.
Yeah.
Even if you don't have a TV, they can say, no, but do you have a radio in your car? So even if you don't ever listen to the radio in your car, you're able to, so you have to pay that license.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Man, there was some crap a while ago where they wanted to start charging, like, giving people TV licenses for, like, cell phones or tablets or something, or laptops. I can't remember.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but it never went through because it was just, like, a scam to try and take more money from people. But it's also a disaster because the SABC, who is our people who do the three channels, are just terribly corrupt and like a joke and like,
and you don't get much for that from those channels.
And then they wanted like bailouts or something a while ago, and it's all disasters, all like mismanaged stolen money or whatever. So but that's the South African way when it comes to government stuff. So it's all like corruption and your money going places it shouldn't, but you just kind of live with that. But so it's kind of this weird oddity. I mean, it's like, not like I say, it's not really a big deal, because if you are at all like kind of middle class or whatever, like, it's a really, really
You can afford it.
It's not a big amount of money. If you can afford a TV, you can probably afford 200 rand, which is like which, like I say, is like $12 or something. So it's, we're not talking about a lot of money, but it's just this like big grudge. So they used to have all these campaigns like, pay your TV license, it's the right thing to do, because they struggle to actually police it.
Yeah,
a lot of people don't pay them. and they'll phone you and phone you and phone you, and people just say, oh,
yeah,
go stuff yourself kind of thing. And then eventually they give up. They're not going to come arrest you for not paying your TV license.
Yeah.
So a lot of people just don't.
Yeah.
I just don't want to deal with getting hassled with phone calls constantly.
Yeah. And also, if you do go and buy a new TV, then you have to show it, which is the main way. That's the only way my TV license has ever been checked.
Yeah.
Is when I go and buy a TV, which I haven't done in years, but I still have to buy the license every year. So
I'm trying to think when I bought my TV, if they even checked it. I feel like they just asked me and I was like, yeah.
They now check. I know they now have to check.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember how I did it, because I bought a TV like a couple of years ago. It wasn't that long ago.
I don't know if you know, but there's a way to not have to pay a TV license. If you don't use broadcast television, you can get someone to come and verify that you don't use it. Wow. And then you're exempt from the TV license. But to get someone to come out and do that, because there are registered people who are allowed to do that, costs more than the TV license.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
Yes.
They probably have to check it every year as well. Yes, just to be sure.
Yeah, you do.
And you know there's people who do that, out of principle. Yeah. There's people who do it.
Yeah, no, it's ridiculous.
That's ridiculous, man. That's so funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a funny country, eh?
Mm.
Yeah, so TV licenses, that's the thing. But essentially what it is it's not like a license to own a TV, although it kind of is.
It kind of is, yeah.
it's essentially is just paying for the free channels.
It's a tax on channels you don't watch.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's an eloquent way of putting it.
Yeah.
Sweet. Okay, we better finish off there.
Yes, yeah.
But yeah, thanks so much for tuning in, guys. Hope you enjoyed that, even though it was a bit long and rambly.
Yeah, no, thanks very much.
Yeah, cheers.
Cheers.
If you would like to get in touch with us, we are at derailed18xx on Instagram and Twitter. You can email us, derailed18xx@gmail.com, and we're on Patreon at patreon.com/derailed18xx. Thanks for listening.